I mistakenly took up the offer of someone working at America's Most Wanted, who suggested I could move into her house since she was going to be moving elsewhere. I agreed to take it without so much as seeing it. Big time rookie mistake. The house was in College Park, Maryland. Not the worst place, but certainly not that inspiring. I'd be sharing the home with five other people I didn't know. And here's the best part. I had a bathroom in my room that other tenants would also use. So when my housemate needed a shit and a shower, he'd tap on my door and get to dumping in my room. Thinking about it is so enraging. I want to go back in time, kill the girl who led me to that shithole of a house, and snap the necks of all my roommates, and then I could be profiled on America's Most Wanted, and life would come around full circle. Socially, I was having a little fun. But I look back now and think I should have probably partied more. What can I say? I was responsible with work and doing what I could with what time I had free. Romantically, it was a roller coaster, but I did manage to go out with a number of women in this short period. I made mistakes. For instance, I went out with two women from work. Huge mistake. One of them was an executive assistant. She tried to get me to have sex with her behind a curtain at her apartment with her roommate on the other side. I understand that this is completely in line with a lot of people's dreams and fantasies, but all I could picture were our grunts and sounds being unwelcome intrusions on the ears of her roommate who I had just met. Call me crazy, but I wanted a wall. Even a thin one would do. I know you guys are like, come on, Tom, stop being a bitch. Pound her behind the curtains, bro. Well, I didn't. I like sex to be between me and a woman surrounded by something thicker than a scarf. She quickly changed her demeanor with me at work, and that should have been a lesson. But then I met an intern. Oops. When you hear intern, you're probably thinking a college girl, and you are correct. But remember, this is me right out of college. Like I graduated 3 months earlier. An intern girl was fun and playful, and to her, I was a grown man, even though we were extremely close in age. We went out on a few dates, and I even stood her up one night. You know, just regular, immature, dumb guy stuff. I was young and insecure. I did get a little action. I slept with my friend's aunt. That wasn't good. She was 32 years older than me and looked like Ed Asner in a wig. I'd gone to a bar with coworkers who were buying me, a lowly recent graduate, a lot of booze. And so my drinking got out of hand. Later, I would learn that I not only slept with my friend's unfortunate-looking aunt, but I also made out with a lady from accounting while at the bar. And yes, she was also much older. So I guess I hooked up with three women that I worked with, often referred to as the Triple Crown by HR departments. I woke up at Aunt Asner's house and couldn't remember much. I found my clothes on her stairs, and when I went to the kitchen, I saw report cards on her fridge. They were from her kids, her grandkids. All I could think was, damn, this bitch is old. I mean, I was 22. Some of the fog of the blackout started to fade, and I was able to recall a few moments from the night before. The memories were followed by intense panic. I had a flashback to kissing her stomach, and as I headed south, her reaching down, grabbing my face, and saying, "You don't want to do that." She warned me like I was about to stick my tongue in the garbage disposal. I guess, if I really think about it, it was extremely courteous of her to realize I wasn't going to enjoy doing that. Kind of like when I signed up to go parasailing in St. Lucia, and the guy running the place looked at me and said, "Are you sure you want to do this? The equipment is so old and you're not, small?" I mean, now that you say that, no, I don't want to try it. I didn't spend all my time going out with women twice my age, but most of my nights were uneventful. Usually I'd just meet up with some friends in Adams Morgan, drink too much, and go home. Those nights are fun and even needed when you're in your early 20s. After a while, it hits you. This can't be it, can it? Staying out late with strangers getting hammered leaves you hungover, obviously, but also wanting more. I was looking for something. For meaning, I wanted to know and to feel that I had a purpose. One night led me on an adventure that I was sure was going to change my life on a millionaire matchmaker twist of fate level. I like to think of it as the night of the lost wallet. It started when, after a few drinks and striking out at a few bars, I hailed a cab, and something happened that had never happened to me before in my life. A woman asked where I was taking the cab and if I wanted to split it with her. Is this real life? Am I about to be picked up by an aggressive lady and torn apart back at her place? God, I hope so. I didn't know much, but I figured I should keep it cool. I looked out the window the way I imagined a cool guy would. You know, like the ones in movies who just look completely intriguing, staring out a window, brooding over life, their purpose, their desires. Is this yours? She said seductively. Is what mine? I was hoping she'd be holding one of her breasts as a kinky way of getting things started. Then I'd go, why, yes, that is mine. And we could put on a show for the driver. I turned and she was holding a wallet, and I went, no, it's not mine. And she said, oh, it must be the previous rider's wallet. I'll just give it to the driver. I stopped her and said, don't do that. Give it to me. I'll get it back to the rightful owner. I know that sounds like something Humphrey Bogart would have said in the 1930s, but I instinctively said it and truly meant it. I imagined this wallet meant something to someone. And my prejudice told me the driver wasn't the kind of guy who'd go out of his way to return it, if you know what I mean. At that moment, I was deciding to take this burden on myself. My fellow passenger didn't hesitate. She looked at the wallet, handed it right over. Now it was all on me. I needed to find the owner. But here's the honest-to-God truth. I really wanted to. I've had wallet-finding fantasies my whole life. I've seen stories in the news, feel-good pieces, where a guy returns a wallet to the owner of a grocery chain. Then the owner tells him, wow, that was awfully nice of you. Have you ever been to Monte Carlo? Come spend the summer on my yacht there. I didn't know what to expect when I opened the wallet, but I wasn't expecting what I found. It had $2, a grocery store rewards card, and a community college ID with a photo and a name. Justin. Justin's photo was as ordinary as his name, just a regular-looking college kid. Everything about it was telling me I should discard it and move on with my life. Why would anyone want this back? Will they not be allowed in the student center for the hypnotist show? Will they no longer get the discount on beer that they most certainly can't afford with $2? I realized that most people would end their quest here. And that would be understandable. I'm not most people, I told myself. It's too easy to quit here. This poor guy, whoever he is, needs this back. I told myself that I had no right to judge the fact that this guy didn't have anything worth a shit in this wallet. It's still his wallet, and it's going to pay off. A minute later, we were at my cab companion's stop. She didn't even turn to say goodnight. She was just gone. But hey, at least I still had this underachiever's wallet on me. At this point, I felt like it was a challenge. I'm a fucking researcher at America's goddamn most wanted. I find international bad guys. I can find this dude. And I really wanted to. I had such hope that it would be inspiring. The kind of story they show you on Good Morning America. The feel-good piece that helps offset all the sadness and despair that fill most newscasts. I imagined an anchor telling the viewers that, against all odds and despite the improbable obstacles in his path, Tom Segura knew he had to return this item to its rightful owner. The tone of the piece would be not unlike the stories of World War II vets who promised they'd deliver a message for a fallen brother. I imagined that the recipient of this item, Justin, would not only be grateful, but curious. Curious about me, and from that, a lifelong friendship would be born. Perhaps a business where we'd both thrive. Certainly, family vacations where the two of us would take turns picking destinations and bringing our families with us. It was going to be amazing. When I got home, I laid out his items and grabbed a notepad and a pen. My plan was to document all my clues and methodically piece this mystery together. I knew it was going to take real work, but I was prepared and inspired by the homicide investigators I'd seen on TV over the years. They didn't give up on solving their cases, and I wasn't going to give up on mine. My first move was to call the grocery store. Looking back, it is laughably, hysterically stupid to think that a grocery store would help you find someone.
Thank you for calling Publix.
Yeah, I'm trying to find someone I've never met. Do you think you can help me?
Are they here in the store?
No, somewhere in the greater metro area.
Would you like to speak to someone in the meat department?
Why not? You've been to grocery stores, right? Not to be rude, but the vibe in most grocery stores, in my experience, isn't one of, let's get our forensic team on this. It's usually more of a, we are willing to overlook felonies if you know how to stock a shelf. I was shot down immediately. The person on the phone didn't even entertain the idea that they could help me find the owner of the wallet.
Yeah, I don't know.
Hung up. My detective instincts perked up. I had my best information right in front of me and I hadn't even used it yet. Mr. Lost Wallet, aka Justin, had a community college ID. I thought it could be wrapped up quickly. I'd call the school, tell them to tell the student I had his lost property, and that'd be it. After a few hours of talking to different departments, I learned that our man was no longer a student. When I asked for contact information, they said, we have a number. Bingo. I was getting warm, and it felt good. I called the number, and instead of hearing hello, I was greeted by what can only be described as the grunt of a man who was shitting and wished he hadn't answered the phone.
Yeah.
Hi, I explained to the man who was presumably grinding out a rugby football-sized turd as he listened on the phone, that I had found this wallet in a cab, pulled out this one identifying card, and the school had directed me to this number. I then asked, are you Justin?
He's my son.
Oh, great. I'm thinking, I solved the case. Yes, I was inconvenienced by having to make two whole phone calls for my investigation, but still, totally worth it. This man is getting his wallet back.
He's a real asshole.
Huh? Who is?
Justin, my son.
Oh. Well, I just want to return his property. But the man, Justin's father, wasn't as interested in my quest as I was.
He never finishes anything he sets out to do. He's a loser, and I don't think he's going to amount to shit.
If I hadn't experienced that call myself, I'd be hard-pressed to believe it. I actually found the parent of a man whose wallet I had in my possession. And the parent not only went out of his way to not accept the property, but also to insult his own son in spectacular fashion. This felt like an episode of Black Mirror. Was Justin's father going to lure me into his life and turn me into the son he never supported, only to verbally abuse me in the way I suspect he must have tormented Justin? I shared the story with a few friends who were mostly incredulous at the man's behavior. After a while, I had to move on. I wasn't going to be spending any more time trying to get this wallet back to Justin. I had exhausted every reasonable course of action to return someone their $2 and their discount card for eggs. A few months later, my cousin Jeanette was visiting town, and we decided to meet up for lunch. We chose a casual eatery in Georgetown, nothing fancy. After we sat down, exchanged a few pleasantries, the server approached our table. He asked whether or not we wanted something to drink. I looked up at him and blurted out, Justin? Confusion immediately crept onto his face. How do you know my name? Dude, I have your wallet. I was glowing, almost hyperventilating. Do you know what Justin's response was? Cool, do you have it on you? First of all, no. I'm not walking around with a second wallet at all times, asshole. Secondly, isn't anyone at least a little impressed that I've stared at this man's community college photo for so long that it's burned into my head, and 2 seconds after seeing him for the first time, I'm able to make a positive ID? Even looking back on that now, I think it's remarkable. I think it's one of the most spectacular, improbable, outrageous moments of my or anyone's life. Justin was ready to move on. Can I get you guys something to drink? Justin might have been calm, but I was truly speechless. I felt destiny had connected us in that moment. It was the only explanation. Why else would I have spent the time and energy to return this man's nearly worthless possession if I wasn't at least going to get to know him? I spent the remainder of that lunch going into every detail with my cousin. She didn't believe me at first, and who could blame her? But as the story unraveled, she became enraptured. You've never met him? No. Tommy, this is so weird. It's fate. Are you going to marry him? Maybe. Maybe this is a sign I should try something really gay with someone. After I paid the check, I approached Justin. Hey, man, so how should I get it to you? Get what? The Mona Lisa. He just stared at me, which I guess is fair. I had made a joke because I thought it was obvious what I wanted to get to him. I didn't just want to return his property. I wanted to hang out. Something was supposed to happen. I believed in it. I imagined we were going to hang out and, I don't know, open a juice bar or build a cabin in the woods or measure each other's dicks. But I didn't want to scare him, so I played it cool. I was kidding. I could return your wallet to you.
Okay.
At this point, I told myself he must be shy. Of course, I wanted more out of him, but he's just reserved. I had recently moved out of the apartment I was living in, so I was staying in a hotel for a few days. I told Justin to meet me there so I could return his wallet. Looking back, it was a little surprising that he had zero apprehension. But then again, he had displayed absolutely no emotion thus far. I'm the one who should have insisted on meeting his cold, lifeless eyes in a public place. I got increasingly nervous as the meeting time we had agreed upon approached. I think I was expecting him to transform into another person or something. I told myself he was simply being professional at work, and now with the chains of employment no longer binding him, he could let loose and be the guy I knew he was capable of being. In my mind, I was going to open my hotel room door, and before I could even say hello, he would throw his arms around me. Perhaps he would present me with a gift that he had bought as a small tribute. He would go on to acknowledge everything I had done and explain what it all meant to him. Then our new life would begin. Justin and me, the two greatest friends ever. My reverie was interrupted by a knock at the door. My heart started to race. This was the moment. If this was being scored like a movie, the music would start to swell here. The violins, the cellos would be building up to the climactic moment. I opened the door. Justin stood in front of me. I held my breath for a beat. I was a little surprised to see his face still conveyed zero emotion. Here's your wallet. I handed it over.
Thanks.
He turned and walked toward the elevator. I watched him press the call button. He didn't say another word or even look back at me. I shut the door and sat on the bed, contemplating what an extraordinarily disappointing interaction I had just experienced. I wanted so much more. This was supposed to be the magical moment that made me feel connected to humanity. The moment where I stopped laughing at people who did yoga and meditated and lit candles as they chanted. This would erase my cynicism and make me one of them. A loving hippy-dippy, the kind I always mocked and dreamed of assaulting. Then it hit me all at once. Justin's dad was right. Justin is a piece of shit. It turns out this was a life-changing moment. I was enlightened by the lost wallet experience. I'd learned something they don't teach you in school. The world is full of disappointment. In sports, jobs, but most of all, in people. The encounter with Justin could have been awesome. I wasn't crazy to want it to be. There are people out there who would have reacted the way I wanted him to. But of course, not everyone can be what you want them to be. That day, I realized there are two types of people in the world. People who would have shit their pants when a stranger called them out by name because the stranger had found their lost wallet. And people like Justin, detached, uninteresting, coasting through life. The world has a bunch of Justins in it, and they are to be avoided. It's like I was watching myself on a bizarro episode of Millionaire. And even though it wasn't one of those happy, fulfilling matches that made me celebrate, the lesson was big enough to make me clasp my hands and say, "Thank you, Patty. Thank you." Jill Scott.
Good morning, everybody. This is American 614, LAX to BNA, 11:22 a.m. Sit back and enjoy the flight.
Asking celebs for photos is a big no-no. I mean, sort of. Obviously, they are famous, and obviously, they are aware that they have fans, and those fans would like to take a picture with them. There are certain situations where taking a photo with a celeb is normal, even encouraged, like at a meet and greet or a celebrity outing, a golf tournament fundraiser, for instance. Famous people get hit up for photos constantly, and they each handle it however they choose to. But there are also times when you're definitely not supposed to ask a celebrity for a photo. And one of those times is when you are actually hanging out with them. If you're at a party or a dinner or, I don't know, sitting next to one on a flight, they're supposed to be able to let their guard down and just talk to you like a regular person. I get that, but I can be weak. Not long ago, I was invited to do a big fundraising show at Madison Square Garden with Pete Davidson. He put together a show where the proceeds would go to charities that benefit victims of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and their families. The lineup was incredible. Dave Chappelle, Jon Stewart, Chris Rock, John Mulaney, and a dozen more comedy stars, plus yours truly. It was an absolute honor to perform on the show. When my best friend from high school, Steve, saw the announced lineup, he told me he'd be flying from Florida to New York City because he had to see it. Steve has always loved getting hooked up with free stuff. In high school, he'd ask the girl working at McDonald's to give him free fries. He'd always angle for an extra set of anything he was buying, socks, oil, iced tea. He lives to see how much pool you have that can benefit him. I knew he'd flip at this event. I got him tickets and a backstage pass and then unleashed him. It was hilarious. Is it cool if I ask Jon Stewart for a picture? I wouldn't. I mean, he's just hanging out. Okay. Hey, Jon, can I get a picture? I cringed. He then did the ultimate faux pas after asking a celeb for a photo. He literally couldn't figure out his phone. It kept facing the wrong way, wasn't taking a photo when he pressed the button, and Jon stood there like a champ. He waited and waited. Steve, clearly nervous, was fumbling his phone like a clumsy bear. Jon waited some more, and the best Steve got was this. Look at your PDF, and you can see this absolutely shitty shot that Steve took, big, stupid Steve with his big, dumb head, of a blurring, moving. It's just a disaster. Way to go, Steve. From there, we went to Chappelle's after party. As you can imagine, more celebrities were casually enjoying themselves at a party where it was announced not to pull out your phone. Chappelle literally got on a mic and said, "We don't take pictures here, we make memories." Moments later, high school Steve had his phone in his hand. That's Pete Davidson. Yeah. Is it cool? I mean, I wouldn't. Hey, Pete, can we? Pete was ear to ear smiling and obliged. I turned to Steve. Fuck it. Ask whoever you want. And I took the photo. It's in the PDF. Check it out. Next was John Hamm, then Q-Tip, and on and on. It wasn't until months later, when I was revisiting chapters in this book, that I realized I'm just like Steve. If you're someone I want a pic with, I'm not going to hold back. Jill Scott hates salmon. There it is. That's all the proof you need that my conversation with her really happened. We flew from Los Angeles to Nashville and talked for a lot of the flight. I recognized her, but I didn't let her know immediately. We were in first class, and when the flight attendant came by, one of the options for the meal was salmon. Now, I'm not insane. I don't get salmon on planes. But when you're down on Earth, like walking around with your feet on the ground, and there's a body of water nearby, Salmon is one of my favorite things to eat. I love salmon, and I told Jill Scott that. I said, salmon's amazing. And she goes, I never eat salmon. Well, how are you having it prepared? In no way. I just do not eat salmon. So I started to describe my favorite way to prepare salmon, which is a classic French technique. Skin on one side of the filet. You put the skin side down in a pan with a lot of butter. Some might say an obscene amount of butter, to which I say there's no such thing. You season your salmon with salt and pepper and place it in the skillet on a low medium heat. And then, after a few minutes, you flip it over. You want high quality salmon, obviously, and it should be cooked medium rare. To achieve this, cook the skin side down for 5 to 6 minutes, then flip it over and cook for another 3 minutes. Now, to feel like a chef, you can tilt the pan and with a spoon, gather the butter that is forming a pool into that spoon and pour it back on your filet. If you want to go all the way Francais, then you're going to need to make some beurre blanc sauce. But even without it, this is one of Tommy's go-tos, and it's delicious. I told her all of this, and she actually seemed intrigued. Okay, I'll try that. Did I just get Miss Jill Scott to try salmon? I asked her how she liked living in Nashville and if people were friendly. And she said, and I quote, I don't need them to be friendly. Just cordial and polite is enough. I nodded in agreement, knowing exactly what she meant. Friendly can be a lot, especially when it's not real. When it's not real, you know it, and it feels gross. Like when a salesperson keeps laughing as they make meaningless small talk. You know, it's fall, so it's not hot, but it's not cold either. Shut the fuck up. It's phony. And then, as the flight was ending, we were pulling up to the gate. I said, do you mind if I get a picture with you? And she said, wow, you're better at this than I am. And I snapped one. Oddly enough, it's one of the only pictures I can't find. Update, I ran into Jill Scott last night in Nashville. I told her we flew together a few years back and went into the details of the story I just shared. And she said, I don't like salmon. I don't fuck with anything pink. I asked her for a pic exactly the way you're not supposed to, and you can see it in your PDF. And also, I found the original photo I took with Jill on the flight, which is also in your PDF. A lot too much. I never imagined I'd be one with any drug stories. In elementary school, I was so clean cut, my hair was parted and combed like a good boy. I just wanted my parents to be happy with me and to continue saying what a sweet kid I was. I didn't even curse until 7th grade. One time, my neighbor Dan and his brother Jimmy across the street grew so fed up with my reluctance to curse that they put me in a headlock and pulled out a knife. Dan told Jimmy, cut him if he doesn't say fuck. I wouldn't do it. Under the threat of permanent and perhaps fatal injury, I refused to say something unbecoming of a fine young boy. Fast forward 30 years and I'm Mr. Fuck Fuck. Fucking you right up your shit shoot, fuckface. I just don't give a fuck. I don't know when I changed, but it was a slow process of trying things that were fun. Drugs were something I associated with losers. People you saw strung out on the streets, those were people who did drugs. I didn't realize that those were just people who did too many drugs. Drugs, like anything, can be a lot of fun if you consume them in moderation. When you take the right amount of drugs, it's great because you're chilling and you're cool and you know you're the best. My older sister first introduced me to drugs, and that's a stretch of a statement because what she introduced me to was weed. I hit the pipe, and then I had a heart attack and was rushed to the emergency room. No, I'm just kidding. That didn't happen, but we'll get to that in a little bit. No, I got moderately high and thought, okay. Later, I would do whippets and smoke a lot more weed at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I wasn't enrolled there. I was 14, visiting my friend's brother, who left a bunch of shit on his coffee table. And since he left us alone in his place, we finished all his drugs for him. I pretty much stuck to weed after that, mostly on the weekends. But my senior year in high school, I decided to up the ante. First, it was ecstasy. Today, the kids call her Molly, but back in the 90s, it was simply X. It was supposed to make you feel like you were jizzing out of all your pores and you were going to be rock hard. At least that's what I was told. I think I must have had a placebo pill because I just acted like that was happening to me. Minus the hard-on. I didn't really fall in love with a drug until I tried GHB. I was led to believe that bodybuilders were taking it after workouts by a classmate who had a ridiculous physique for a 16-year-old. I mean, this kid had the kind of size and definition you see on a dedicated adult bodybuilder. My desire to be ripped without working out and dieting made it the perfect match for me. The street version of GHB was sold at the time in 20-ounce water bottles, the kind you've probably drunk from for years. These bottles were filled with a liquid that at a glance might make you think it was just water. A closer look would reveal what was inside was yellowish in hue and tasted just like ocean water. To give you an idea of the potency of the GHB we were taking at the time, a hit would be one bottle cap. The bottle cap on a bottle of water is all you needed to get absolutely lit. How much fluid does it take to fill up the cap of a water bottle? 6 droplets? 10? This shit was straight gas, homie. After you were able to get past the horrific taste, you were about 30 seconds from euphoria. We used to call it permagrin. I had never done any other hard drugs, but this felt the way those drugs were portrayed. In movies, they always show someone shooting up heroin and then lying back as their eyes roll into the back of their heads. GHB did that to me. I didn't always pass out, but I always felt good. Someone could spit in my face, and my response would be, maybe he thought I was thirsty. Finally, I found a drug I could really throw my weight behind. We were so cocky my senior year of high school, in only the way seniors in high school can be, that we began doing hits of GHB during our lunch break, a free period where we were permitted to leave campus and returned for the remainder of the school day out of our minds high. The arrogance, in retrospect, was astounding. I remember Craig, the kid who introduced me to G, was particularly brazen with it. We had just stuffed our faces with Miami subs when he did a quick hit. He casually asked me if I wanted one too. My nerves took over. Before we go back? We still had 3 periods left. I mean, I was still transitioning from the good boy who parted his hair to this guy who was doing drugs.
Who's gonna know?
Well, that's all it took. I was convinced. No one ever suspected a thing. GHB didn't make your eyes red the way weed did, and it didn't impede your ability to listen or follow instructions the way alcohol would. You just felt great and no one knew it. I did have a fair warning scare once, but I was too young and too dumb to pay attention to it. I went to a Clint Black concert with friends and did some hits throughout the night, but on the way home, a couple of us blacked out. When we woke up, we realized we had lost a lot of time. We had no sense of what we had seen or done or how much time had gone by. Turns out it was about 2.5 hours. We were used to the idea of alcohol blackouts. While scary, they make sense. They usually happen because you went overboard with liquor. You can only blame yourself because the warning is explicit. 32 ounces of Everclear and Gatorade is going to end poorly. But we hadn't had any alcohol. Just a handful of sips of some Georgia Homeboy. Just like we usually do over the course of a night. The blackout scared us. Not enough to quit, of course. Just enough to not do any more that night. When I went to Lenoir Ryan University a few months later, I brought a full 20-ounce bottle of GHB with me. This would typically last me 2.5 months. I didn't account for my tolerance increase and, more importantly, my sadness. I was depressed and getting more so as reality set in. I was leaving what I knew, and instead of the big college campus I had dreamed of going to, I was in a sleepy country town in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. During the 10-hour drive to campus, I sat in the back of my parents' SUV. I'd fumble through my bag and sneak shots whenever they were distracted, which was pretty much the whole time. I was high for the majority of the drive, and as soon as they waved goodbye at drop-off, I took another hit. Clearly, I was looking for an escape, and my water bottle was all I needed. My first memory of being at college as a brand new first-year student was going to my dorm room and hearing that there was a freshman orientation in the auditorium. We were required to attend. I skipped and got high alone in my room. If I'm being honest, I was lonely, insecure, and slightly depressed. I didn't want to be in this hillbilly town in North Carolina, but I didn't see any other options. College was mandatory in my family. It wasn't even plausible that someone would bring up not going to college. I had fantasies of being a filmmaker at the time, and I thought comedy would be my route. I never applied to a proper film school. I was too intimidated, given that mediocre schools were already turning me down because of my horrendous high school GPA, and I was holding on to the idea of playing football. I rationalized that I would get into a communications program, and they have radio, print, and video specialties. Video isn't film, but at least it's making something you can show people. I went to Lenoir Rhine because it was literally the only school that accepted me. My first few weeks at school, I was getting high constantly and doing so in secret from my roommate. I was doing it so much that my stash soon ran out, and now I was looking for my favorite drug in a new town. Trying to find GHB, if you haven't guessed, isn't like trying to find weed. Most people had no idea what you were asking for, but as luck would have it, one guy did. He was a sixth-year senior, a dum-dum. I first encountered him when I was looking for weed. I was told he was someone to ask. But he had a lot of questions for me. You're a freshman? Yeah. Where are you from?
Florida.
Florida, huh? What brought you here?
School. We both go to school here, man.
It didn't take me long to realize that he and a few others I'd met were hesitant to sell to me because of my physical appearance. Not that I'm particularly intimidating, but I did look older. In my circle of friends, I've been called the Albert Pujols of comedy. This is a reference to the regular practice of Dominican baseball prospects doctoring their birth certificates to appear younger than their real age. At 17, I was buying booze without a fake ID. Not only did the cashiers not even ask for ID, but they also called me sir. Sir! People guessed I was in my late 20s. The trend continues to this day. As of this recording, I'm 42, but I'm often told, I thought you were in your 50s. Very flattering. A big part of it then and now is the beard. It's an age enhancer, and as the gray settles in, the age people guess goes up. I started shaving when I was 14, and I could grow decent stubble at 17. I did it then because I could. It was a subtle reminder to my less hairy friends, I'm definitely more of a man than you. When the drug dealer had me asking him for an unusual, difficult-to-find liquid downer, he was majorly suspicious, thinking I might be a narc, but he agreed to get a hold of some, and I was thrilled. He demanded that we do the deal in the entryway of one of the dorms. It was clear he wanted to control the environment. When I arrived, he was waiting on the opposite end of the hall, about 30 feet away, staring at me like we were about to pull pistols in a duel. I knew he was wondering if I was a cop, and I didn't know how to convince him I wasn't. As I walked toward him, he put one hand up, signaling me to stop. He looked around as if at any moment my backup was going to kick open the doors behind me, guns drawn, and holler at him to get on the fucking ground! I just stared back with my blank face and gestured, what now? He gave the universal single hand gesture for, where's the cash? The whole thing felt like charades for entry-level drug dealers. I held up the money, and he pointed at a payphone. As I walked over to place the cash down, I saw the bottle. Yes, dude. I was so excited to have my old friend back. I put the money where he'd pointed and hauled ass back to my room, ready to get down with ocean water sips and perma smiles. What I had in my hand, though, was a far inferior product. It was GHB Light. Them Florida boys had the ill shit, and these Carolina crackers had some heavily diluted, weak bullshit. The Carolina stuff wasn't the right color. It was more clear, the taste was not as sharp, and the effect was lame. What was I going to do? I doubled up on shots and got as high as I could. It was a serious letdown. Eventually, I stopped buying it because the Carolina product wasn't worth the hassle. I'd rather just smoke a bunch of weed. It wasn't that big of a sacrifice. I was smoking weed nightly with some new friends in the dorm and enjoying the hell out of it. It was the first time away from home for all of us, and we bonded with one another over what we loved. Weed, music, and laughing. We'd hit the bong, listen to hip-hop, and play Madden until the sun rose. It actually hit me by surprise when it was time to go home for Thanksgiving break. That's when I remembered I could get some of the good stuff again. My first time home as a college student now had a purpose. I wouldn't just be seeing my family and hang out with high school friends. I'd have a real opportunity to load up on some Go Hard Boss sauce and bring it back to college. The way it worked in Vero Beach, Florida, the day after Thanksgiving was the big day to party. That Friday, I met up with a huge group of high school friends and found the guy who had always had the good stuff in high school. I was ready to get ripped on my favorite three-letter combo. He told me he'd have some later, but that I might not even want it because he had gotten a hold of some primo ecstasy from Miami. I was hesitant because I was sure of what the GHB would do to me, and I had a prior experience with X that was disappointing, but my dealer said this was different, that I couldn't be let down by these pills. Just get me the G, dude.
Later. I'll have some later, but this shit's killer. Newest shit from the 305.
It sounded like I would have to wait, but this was the only other thing he had. So I gave him cash, ate the pill, and within a few minutes, I was disappointed. I didn't feel anything. I ran over to him. Hey, man, I don't feel shit.
You just took it. Give it 30 minutes.
Fuck, 30 minutes? See, that was the beauty of the liquid stuff. You barely waited 30 seconds. I thought, okay, in 30 minutes, I'm going to be coming out of every pore. 45 minutes later, nothing. And worse, I couldn't find my dealer. I wanted to feel something now. I did what I had the easiest access to, a drink, and then another. About 30 minutes later, there was a company move. Everyone was heading over to Bobby's, a well-known bar on the beach. As soon as I got there, I had a couple screwdrivers. I was on my way to getting fucked up, but it was drunk fucked up, not the high kind that I craved. I just kept drinking. As I was on my way back to the bar, I spotted him, my former classmate, current drug supplier. I was elated. He saw the look on my face, and he knew right away what I wanted, a swig of that salty water.
All right, come on, Tom.
Dude, I never felt that ecstasy.
Really?
What I was definitely feeling were those screwdrivers. By this time, I had lost count, but it could have easily been a dozen. I was drunk. We went out to his car, and I sat in the passenger seat. He pointed at the ground between my legs, and there it was, something I had never seen before, a 1 gallon jug of GHB. Quick reminder, I had only had standard 20-ounce water bottles full of the stuff, which is how the dealers distribute it to the consumers. This jug was pre-distribution. A gallon wasn't only astonishing in volume, but also unorthodox. How am I supposed to take a hit? You can't pour it into the cap on a gallon jug.
Take a swig.
I picked up a full 1 gallon jug of GHB and held it up to my lips. How much do I sip? What's a bottle cap worth? How many screwdrivers have I had? A moment later, my mouth was full. Full of GHB. I had tipped back way too much. I knew it was too much. My first thought was, you can't spit it out. It's drugs.
It's valuable. I hesitated for a second, then swallowed. Whoa. How much did I just take? That was way more than a water bottle cap. 5? Was it 7? 10? I put the jug down, thanked him, and I was ready to rock. I went straight to the bar for a couple more screwdrivers. I was dancing, high-fiving, and just generally having a hell of a time. I sat down for a break, and it hit me. I was fucked up. Oh, well, who cares? I'm chilling with a girl on my lap and people all around. That was it. My last memory of the evening. I woke up 8 hours later, staring at fluorescent lights. I was restrained. I couldn't sit up. I couldn't move my arms. For a brief moment, I felt absolute terror. A woman I recognized leaned over me. She was a classmate's mother, a doctor. "Tommy, you overdosed. You're in intensive care at the hospital." Fuck. How is this real? I closed my eyes and wished as hard as I could. Not that I would recover, but that my parents wouldn't find out. Then I opened my eyes, and there they were, looking at me. I'll never forget that look. I killed a part of them that day. Next, the nurses put a pen in my hand, the hand I do not write with. They held out a pad of paper and told me they needed to know what happened so they could treat me accordingly. I already had tubes in my nose and others going down my throat. They were pumping my stomach full of liquid charcoal, so the chemicals in whatever I took would come together and a forced regurgitation would take place. Before I could explain what happened, I had to deal with my parents. The look on their faces. I scribbled on the pad, "Are you mad at me?" They both shook their heads. And then my dad added, "We're not mad at you, Tommy. Just disappointed." "Hey, thanks, dude. Think you could have skipped saying that since I'm, you know, coming out of a coma? No? Okay, cool." Next, the doctors pressed me. "What did you take? We need to know what's in you." I jotted down, "Heroin." Everyone's eyes bugged out. You could hear the air conditioning coming through the vent. And after a beat, I wrote, "Kidding." Not a lot of laughs, but it did make me feel better. I spent 2 more days puking in the ICU. Every blood vessel in the whites of my eyes ruptured. I looked like I had gone up to Cain Velasquez and told him his mother was a cunt. After yet another day, I was finally in a normal recovery room when the doctor who saved me, the one who was able to fit a breathing tube down my throat when no one else could, came to visit. He told me he had never seen a toxicology report like mine where the patient ended up alive. It turns out I had basically everything in me. Barbiturates, amphetamines, cocaine. I didn't understand. I didn't take those things. The drugs you thought you were taking were spiked. They were cocktails of other drugs. Happens a lot. I just can't believe you're still here. I thought about it. How did I survive? Don't give me that miracle shit. There has to be a real world reason. I asked him why he thought I made it through. He looked at the chart and then to me. 250 pounds. That's a lot. Sometimes it's good to be fat.
Concha mi madre.
My mother has a very direct way of speaking. She doesn't have the ability to bite her tongue. When my father's brother was moments from remarrying, after his 36-year marriage ended, my mother called my father and insisted that she speak to my uncle since she wasn't able to attend. My uncle no doubt thought he was going to hear congratulations or well-wishing of some kind. Instead, my mother told him that she was sorry to say it, but she thought he was making a huge mistake. He shouldn't marry the woman he was mere moments from exchanging vows with. I can't imagine saying that to someone. I can't imagine what it must be like to hear that when you're literally minutes from tying the knot. But I can imagine my mother doing that. Not only because I was at the wedding staring at my uncle as he took the call, but because my whole life my mom has said whatever is on her mind to me and everyone else. Her justification for being so direct is that she can't not be herself. I think the rest of us would be thrilled if sometimes she could stop being herself and become someone else entirely. She tells you exactly what she thinks about the way you look, what you're wearing, what you're doing in life, who you're dating, how you should feel, your opinions, thoughts, career, and what you should buy her. Literally, today, the day I'm recording this, she called to tell me that there weren't any cars that she could find locally to purchase. That is, of course, not true. There are a dozen dealerships less than 3 miles from where she lives. If you understand my mother, you'd know that this translates to, "Will you buy me a car?" My reply was, "Keep looking. I'm sure you'll find one." My favorite asshole move of hers is when she tells you not to be upset about something. Maybe the dog jumped on your back and scratched you, or you just found out you didn't get the job you wanted. She has this really spectacular talent for waiting until the exact worst moment, down to the second, when you're completely frustrated, before she drops the always helpful, "Don't be upset." It's pretty cool. If that's a lot to take in, imagine if I were describing your goddamn mother, because that is mine. She is a tornado of tumultuous emotions wrapped in a petite Latina woman's body. She'll look you dead in your eyes and tell you, "You don't look good," while she's wearing 35-year-old pajamas and her hair looks like it has been set on fire. She'll tell you that you're wasting your money on something you want to indulge in for yourself, but she will follow it up by telling you that she needs the new iPhone. My favorite of her hilarious hypocrisies is her guidance on health and wellness. She will lecture anyone within earshot about what they should be doing to achieve optimum human performance. She will display a face of horror while you eat something that she finds unappetizing or unhealthy. "How many pieces of bacon are you going to have? My God, you're going to turn into a pig." "It's only 2 pieces of bacon." "Yeah, but look how big they are. The 2 pieces might as well be 6 pieces. That's probably the nicest exchange you can have with her about what you're eating. A lot of times, it's much more dramatic. A cringe face followed by, "Ah, what is that? Yuck. You're eating fish in a disgusting sauce. I want to vomit." Such a fun way to enjoy your meal, right? You're just eating dinner and the commentary is free. Then there are her exercise opinions. "You need to run and do some weights. Right now it's too hot. Wait until after dinner." I should point out that she is small, 5'5" and maybe 110 pounds. You might be thinking, "Wow, she's so healthy. Just sharing her insights, huh?" Not exactly. My mom eats like a toddler. I don't mean that she eats exactly what a toddler eats. What I mean is that she eats what a toddler wishes they could eat all day. My mother begins her day by having 2 pieces of toast covered in butter and a super rich jam of some kind. Apricot and strawberry jams have been a fixture in her diet for decades. That toast can hold her over for hours. She often skips lunch, but she doesn't skip snacks. She likes pastries like prune bear claws, cookies, and a sweet Italian bread called panettone. These are the foods that fuel her midday. Once those nutrients are done being absorbed by her desperate muscles, it's on to dinner. Here is where 9 times out of 10, her desired meal is chicken tenders, a small serving of rice, and French fries. I've seen her request this at Michelin-starred restaurants. "Mom, this is one of the best restaurants in the world. Don't you want to try their signature dish?"
"I want fries."
Cheap date, sure, but how can you pass on this world-class food? For her, this isn't even a consideration. As I mentioned before, she can be a real asshole. It's actually impressive. She'll ask if you're dumb because you said something or did something that she simply doesn't agree with. She's called me every name in the book, which is sort of ironic given that she is such a devout Catholic. But I'm sure she's asked for forgiveness and the big man gave it to her, so all is well. She often turns to, "I have to tell you how I feel." No, you don't. You really can keep some thoughts and feelings to yourself. Thankfully, there's some balance to her. Just when you can't take her criticism anymore, she'll do something amazing, like one of her widely celebrated farts. Seriously, we, her family, have been in awe of her wind valve for decades. Early in the morning, late at night, and everywhere in between, this little lady can rip ass. It's astonishing. Most people think it's an embellishment, and I understand why. But miraculously, I captured one of my mom's massive gas releases on video and shared it with the world. She's understandably not thrilled about it, but I consider it payback for her way of interacting with the rest of us. It's all over the internet and has been featured on dozens of channels because it truly is an other level fart. A friend said he timed it at 9.12 seconds. I told him she's had better ones. It's true. I have an aftermarket exhaust on my car that I paid a fortune for, and it doesn't come close to the notes she can reach with her horn. I can already hear how she'll react to this chapter.
The things you write about your own mother. Que Dios te perdone.
You know, Mom, I love you.
Yeah, sure, Tommy.
Come on, Mom.
You're going to have to pay for this one.
Oh, yeah? What are we talking about here?
You put it in your book, Tommy. I still can't find the car.
America's Most Wanted. I moved to Washington, D.C. on September 10th, 2001 to begin my first showbiz job. You know now that during college I had interned at America's Most Wanted, the long-running show that profiled and led to the capture of some of the most dangerous people on Earth. Soon after graduating, they offered me a job, and I accepted. The first day they set me up in an office that was already occupied by another guy named Tom. So the two Toms were kept together in one place. There was a lot of Tom. The other Tom knew it and referred to our space as T-squared and T2. The other Tom was an on-air reporter. He would go into the field and be seen on TV talking about one of these horrific human beings we were profiling. My job was a lot shittier. I had the fun task of being a researcher. I had to find fugitives for us to chase. Basically, I would look up who had jumped bail or who had eluded authorities, and then I would get as much info on the person as possible before pitching to our story editor why we should do a segment on said fugitive. It might sound kind of cool, but what you can't gather is just how somber and depressing it is to research felons for 12 hours a day. One particularly epic piece of shit had been convicted of child sex crimes in Honduras and Costa Rica. But as is customary down there, he was able to bribe his way out. He was American, and we wanted to send his ass back to prison in Costa Rica. That was enough info for us to pursue him, but in this asshole's case, there was also a diary. This scum of the earth detailed his stalking, seducing, and sexual exploits with children. If you ever want to feel nauseated, read a child predator's diary. I pitched that we should go after this guy, and we did. They sent me to Costa Rica to work as a translator for the episode. And to this day, I don't know if we got him because I left the show after that week. I had already left DC and had just started settling down in LA to pursue all my showbiz dreams. While I was down in Costa Rica, I had to interview several people for this show. I had a producer, cameraman, audio guy, and a local guide with me. Our first interview was an American man who dedicated his life to saving and helping young women who had been abused. He was so committed to this cause that he moved down there and never left. Costa Rica has legal prostitution, but economic inequities have led to a lot of exploitation of underage girls. This man's life was saving these young, abused girls. Next, they had me interview a victim who had been kidnapped, assaulted, impregnated, and neglected. Her story was so extreme and stunning that as she told me what happened to her, I cried. At first, it was just a little bit. My eyes welled up and I was trying to make it go away. This girl was completely composed while she talked about the brutal things she suffered. The least I could do was hold it together. I looked up, I looked down, and then I looked at her. and the tears rolled down my cheeks. One or two to start, and then the stream flowed. There was a brief moment where I thought she was going to stop telling her story, but she didn't, thankfully. She kept going, and she let me cry about it. Afterward, my cameraman put his hand on my shoulder and gave me a little squeeze, partially to comfort me, but it also had a bit of, "This might not be for you," in it. America's Most Wanted wasn't all bad, though. I got to spend a good deal of time at the White House, which is a thrill at that age. After 9/11, we started sending reporters to the lawn outside the West Wing. If that doesn't make sense to you, think about it. After 9/11, who became the most wanted person in the world? Bin Laden. And why the White House? Well, they couldn't stop talking about it either. On television, you see White House reporters posted up in the same area on the lawn. Every network and news channel has someone standing there. I would call